On February 17, 1970, physician Jeffrey McDonald called the police to his Fort Bragg, North Carolina home. He told the responding officers that he had been assaulted by a group of hippie intruders who had also bludgeoned and stabbed his wife and two young daughters, ages 2 and 5, to death. McDonald suffered a concussion and collapsed a lung, but did survive. The police did not believe him. Weeks later, Army investigators named him the chief suspect in the murders of his family. A series of investigations and trials followed, and McDonald was convicted of 3 counts of homicide in 1979, 9 years later. Although he was freed on bail for 2 years while he ultimately unsuccessfully appealed his conviction, he has now spent decades behind bars for the murders, which, according to our next guest, says he probably didn't commit. Errol Morris, the private investigator, former private investigator and documentary filmmaker whose 1988 movie The Thin Blue Line resulted in an innocent man being freed from prison. In A Wilderness of Errors, his second book, Morris maintains that McDonald's trial was rigged in favor of the prosecution and the authorities pursued an unethical vendetta against the surgeon, essentially railroading him. Errol Morris joins us live this morning. Errol, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
The book is endlessly fascinating. It is complete. It is really something that I devoured it, and I have to say, you make a very, very compelling case. I want to start our discussion by a question of what it is about this case in particular that has enthralled so many of us for all of these decades. As I mentioned, this happened in 1970. I was 3 years old when this case happened. Yet, for 40 years, it's been in the news, and it has captivated us.
Tricky. Are people still interested in a 42-year-old murder case? I am, because the case has bothered me. Maybe not for 40 years, but it's bothered me for close to 20. Yes, I used to be a private investigator, turned filmmaker, now writer. I got a man out of prison 25 years ago because I stumbled on a case that didn't ring true. There was something wrong about it. There was something that didn't make sense about it. And I kept pursuing it until I was able to show the man who had been convicted was innocent, and I got the real killer to confess. This isn't the same story, but there has... I've been bothered by it.
What bothered you? What were the nagging doubts? I mentioned the basics of the story in the introduction, where you have this surgeon who blames this horrible crime, the death, the murder of his wife and two daughters, on a gang of hippies, of hippie intruders.
And that story was seen to be the unbelievable, cockamamie, ridiculous story. Right. A gang of hippies broke into your house, slaughtered your family, left you alive, injured but alive. Tell us another. What we forget is that these crimes, February 1970, were just months after the Manson killings in California.
Right.
The idea of murderous hippies, maybe it sounds ridiculous today. It certainly was not ridiculous then. I would say two kinds of things bothered me. The evidence supposedly tying him to the crimes was weak. I didn't buy the arguments that had been made by the investigators and the prosecutors. But there's something that bothered me even more. There was an alternate story, the story of those hippies. Because guess what? A hippie girl who was a narcotics informant in Fayetteville, this is Fort Bragg, North Carolina, just outside of Fayetteville, a hippie girl who is a narcotics informant started confessing to having been in the house that night. There are a whole mess of coincidences involving this woman and her friends, Helena Stokely, that just simply can't be waved away. And when I say coincidences, I put quotation marks around that word. I ask an important question in my book, A Wilderness of Error. When does a set of coincidences become something more than coincidences? When do they become evidence? No, this is a story that won't go away and shouldn't go away, because even if I can't prove with 100% certainty that he's innocent, I can prove with 100% certainty that he did not get a fair trial.
You talk about that quite extensively in the book, about the trial and basically about how the crime scene was compromised for a number of reasons.
Compromised is putting it politely.
Well, you spent an entire book, obviously, in setting up some of the compromises within this case. However, my interest is at what do you get a, do you have a sense at in your opinion at what point, if what you are saying is true, at what point they blew it?
I think they blew it in the first hours of the investigation. Because they became convinced, for bad reasons, I don't know how else to put it, that he was guilty. And here's the big problem. It's a problem in investigations in general. If you go into an investigation with a certain mindset, if you're convinced things happened one way rather than another, you stop looking for certain kinds of evidence. If you're convinced that there were no intruders, that he was responsible for the death of his family, you stop looking for any kind of evidence that would point in a different direction. Another problem, something that is true of all investigations, certainly all crime scene investigations, is that evidence is perishable. You don't collect it, you don't look for it. It isn't going to sit around and wait for you forever. And so a lot of the evidence in this case was lost. Fingerprints were collected in such a way that they could not be used. Other fingerprints were destroyed. Other fingerprints were not collected at all. The crime scene was a mess, too. It was like a soccer field where... or a field of scrimmage where people had just run over the playing field with track shoes back and forth to the point where you can never be sure what was there and what wasn't.
I do want to talk for a moment, because it is the baseline for so many of us about this case, of how we learned about it, and perhaps answering my first question, which is why so many of us are enthralled by it, but that is Joe McGinnis's book, Fatal Vision, and the subsequential TV movie with Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint and Gary Cole playing Jeffrey McDonald. All of those endeavors were very, very popular. But obviously they brought up a number of questions. They brought up a number of questions about the case, and then in subsequent years brought up a number of questions about Joe McGinnis, about his reporting, and of course about the innocence of Jeffrey McDonald. When you look at this case, when it comes to Joe McGinnis, his reporting in his book, how big a role do you think that played in where we are right now, And what were the fundamental flaws with that?
Well, certainly Joe McGinnis did not create this nightmare, but he perpetuated it and helped to make it much worse. Part of what I try to tell about this case is it's a story about a prison darker than any prison we might have imagined, say, 100 years ago. I compare this with the Count of Monte Cristo. It's not about being thrown into some dark dungeon from which there can be no escape. This is a media prison, a narrative prison. The case, of course, was presented to a jury. Maybe a couple of million people read about it. Joe McGinnis's book was read by 6 million people. There was a huge 60 Minutes show in which McGinnis's arguments were repeated to an audience of tens of millions of people. And the TV movie where we see McDonald kill his family over and over and over again was seen by 60 million people. So it's as if everyone thinks they were in the house. They witnessed the crime. They saw it. Look, I saw the TV movie. I read the book. I saw the 60 Minutes episode. I saw it with my own eyes. The only problem here is it's a false narrative, and it is not supported by evidence. And here's my worry. Can I get people to read and to think about a case where so much time has gone by? Could you argue, well, you know, he's already been in prison forever. Should we just simply forget about it? It's over and done with. And my answer is, of course not. It's in the interests of justice and fairness that this case be reexamined and the errors that were made in the past corrected.
One of the things that I found fascinating in reading the book, and especially with your interview with Jeffrey McDonald, is that in the interviews that I have seen with him, and yes, also certainly supported in the McGinnis account, but even in this book, he does come off rather arrogant.
Well, I am
certainly not saying that just because he has an arrogance means that he's guilty. However, it is interesting that I would think. And I guess this is my ultimate question. His the way he behaved immediately following the crimes and the way he has behaved throughout the years seems to be inconsistent, many feel, with a normal human emotion about the killing of his family, and then ultimately, if true, the fact that he was railroaded and serving a lot of time for a crime he didn't commit.
Well, I've been asked in connection with the book, Wilderness of Error, why didn't I speak to Jeffrey more? There's just really one central interview that I did with McDonald.
Right.
And the answer is, over the years I would see McDonald on Larry King. He would appear again and again and again. And it was as if the television audience was asked to scrutinize the interview and to decide on that basis, is he guilty or innocent? Almost a popularity contest. There used to be a show on in the 50s called Queen for a Day, and people would applaud
right.
if they found the story believable or not. To me, that's not what this case is about. I happen to like Jeffrey McDonald. But my views about his guilt or innocence are not based on his likability or whether I like him or not. They're based on other kinds of evidence.
When it comes to where this stands right now, he is still looking for another trial, yes?
He's going to have a hearing. This is a big deal. He goes before a federal judge next Monday in Wilmington, North Carolina. That would be Monday, September 17th.
And this was scheduled for August. Has it now been moved to September? And what are we looking for? What is he looking for to be the result of this hearing?
This is the first time in over 30 years that all of the evidence, remember, a lot of the evidence was hidden, suppressed at the trial. A lot of evidence came to light after the fact. This will be the first time that his lawyers can present all of the evidence in one courtroom. And the hope is that the 1979 conviction will be overturned.
Do you have any involvement in the sense of the information that you have discovered in this process, or is this information that the defense already has?
I don't know.
Are you interested in getting involved?
Well, I am involved. I wrote a book.
Right.
And have spent...
But you're not working on behalf of his defense.
No, I am not.
Yeah.
I think it's much better that way. He has good lawyers. The lawyers are going to present the case. My guess is that some of the material that I have uncovered will be part of that case, but I do not know for sure.
Do you think that he has a chance, given all of the twists and turns, a chance of ever having this sentence reversed?
Yes. Quite simply, yes. I would be lying if I said it's going to be easy, that it isn't a long shot. But the evidence is on his side. I truly believe if the jury in 1979 had heard a lot of the evidence that we know about today, that they would never, ever, ever have convicted him of these crimes. There's a standard in this country. Beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's more than a reasonable doubt in this case. My hope is that either the federal judge or the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals will do the right thing and overturn the 79 conviction.
And does the hearing then call for a new trial, or do they have that power of overturning?
They overturn, and I suppose the Justice Department could seek a new trial. I can't quite imagine how they could ever try this case again. They got a conviction 30 years ago by hiding a lot of the evidence, by suppressing lab notes, psychiatric testimony, and essentially by removing Helena Stokely from the case, neutralizing her. They can no longer do that. My guess, I don't know this for sure, is that they would decline to prosecute. If the case is overturned, I believe he will walk out of prison.
We will see, certainly. The name of the book is A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. The book is published by the Penguin Press. And obviously it's a very disturbing case, but it's a fascinating book.
Anybody interested in investigations, this is an odd book because it allows you to investigate the case with me. It presents the evidence. It allows you to think about the evidence. And I would urge people to read it and come to their own conclusions.
A Wilderness of Error, published by the Penguin Press. Errol Morris, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Errol Morris, again, author of A Wilderness of Errors, published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.